Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Here on the Aerospace Advantage, we speak with leaders in the DoD, industry, and subject matter experts who explore the intersection between strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So if you like learning about aerospace power, you are in the right place. To our listeners, thank you so much for coming back. And if it's your first time here, thank you so much for joining us. Now, modernizing our Air Force over the past 30 years has been, well, let's just say a major challenge. We've talked a lot about that here at the Mitchell Institute. We have the smallest and oldest fleet of aircraft in our history. You've also heard us say that our fifth generation combat platforms are flying with third generation weapons. While the munitions might not exactly be third generation, the reality is we have not modernized our precision-guided weapons to match the capabilities of what our fifth-gen aircraft were designed to do. Now, let me explain this quickly. The majority of our fighter and bomber fleets now employ a variation of the Mark 82 or Mark 84 bomb body. These bombs were designed out of a 1946 post-World War II study and have been in use since Vietnam. While we have improved their fusing and guidance mechanisms, the reality is we've invested a lot of money to design new generations of aircraft, but we're still trying to get the same old weapon to the target. Now, this is just one small, rudimentary example of what we're trying to bring to light on today's podcast. Trust me, there's a lot more to talk about when it comes to the need for modernizing munitions to go into a high-end fight with the likes of China or Russia. Mark Gonzo Gunzinger, Mitchell's Director of Future Concepts and Capability Assessments, has been tracking this capability gap for years. He has recently published an incredible paper titled Affordable Mass, the Need for a Cost-Effective PGM Mix for Great Power Conflict. You can find a link for that paper on today's show notes or on our website at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Now, Mark is here with us to talk about his findings and how we can close the gap with an affordable mix of PGM options. Again, congratulations on a great paper, and thanks again for taking the time to discuss it today.
Hey, Slick. Great to be here today.
We are incredibly fortunate to have Major General Jason Armo Armagas, Director of Strategic Plans, Programs, and Requirements, Air Force Global Strike Command, with us to discuss the topic from the warfighter's perspective. Armo, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you again for having me. I really enjoyed the last discussion we had, and I think this is an incredibly important topic, and I really look forward to Gonzo's perspective and the back and forth we'll have on it.
All right, let's get started with Gonzo. Gonzo, in the intro, I talked about how fighters and bombers need to get to the target to deliver their precision-guided munitions, or PGMs. And I'm sure most folks have watched the news footage of a bomb striking a target dead center in the crosshairs of a targeting pod. When we hear PGM, most folks probably think of this type of scenario. Can you explain PGMs beyond this legacy concept?
Yeah, sure, Slick. So when people think of precision strikes, they often think of airstrikes that they saw on TV during Operation Desert Storm, Iraqi Freedom, and of course, counter-terror strikes over the last 20 years. However, before Desert Storm, airmen had to rely on using large numbers of so-called dumb bombs that lack precision to strike targets. In fact, during World War II, thousands of these unguided gravity bombs and hundreds of fighter and bomber sorties were sometimes needed to destroy large area targets, such as munitions factories and oil depots. Even in the 1980s, I remember when I was flying high-altitude B-52 training missions, where unguided bomb scores of less than 1,000 feet for attacks on practice targets were considered pretty decent. So the advent of precision guidance, combined with new ISR systems and networks that could provide targeting information directly to strike aircraft, revolutionized how we conduct our air campaigns. Now, the use of laser-guided bombs and other guided weapons really began to ramp up during 1991's Operation Desert Storm. And post-war analyses determined that those LGBs were responsible for the majority of target kills during that air campaign, even though coalition air forces dropped far more dumb bombs than PGMs. So, instead of multiple sorties per target, airmen began to plan for multiple targets per sortie. Because of these more accurate bombing systems and individual weapons, they could strike targets with 10-meter and better accuracy. But as you suggested, this leap ahead in precision also had a major impact on the Air Force's combat forces. In a sense, the Air Force became the victim of its own success, because a series of Air Force force structure cuts began after Desert Storm, and frankly, if continued to present day, were partly justified by the fact that its fighters and bombers were far more capable than ever before, including for precision strikes. And I remember that was the exact logic used to rationalize force cuts during DoD's 1993 bottom-up review. Plus, a new generation of PGMs, such as the GPS-guided JDAM, or Joint Direct Attack Munition, developed in the 1990s, has become the weapon of choice for airstrikes in permissive operational environments like the ones we've seen over the last 30 years. American airmen have launched many thousands of JDAMs, Hellfire missiles, and other direct attack weapons on targets in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. But the problem is, our munitions inventory still mostly consists of direct attack weapons that really are best suited for strikes on enemies that lack effective air missile defenses. Because like it did with too many of its other capabilities, DoD took a strategic pause in fielding new weapon systems suitable for peer conflicts, with some exceptions like JASSM and LRASM, which are low observable cruise missiles.
That makes a ton of sense. Now, can you talk about how PGMs and precision strikes in the context of a potential conflict with a peer adversary, specifically beyond the need for direct attack munitions?
So our listeners are probably aware that a fight against the Chinese or Russian militaries would not be like air campaigns we fought against lesser aggressors in the past. For instance, our peer adversaries have developed highly effective defenses against our legacy non-stealthy bombers and fighters. Their advanced integrated air defenses include surface-to-air and air-to-air missiles with hundreds of miles range that are highly effective against these non-stealthy aircraft. And that means those aircraft, which frankly still make up about 80% of the Air Force's CAF, will not be able to routinely approach close enough to targets in those contested areas to use very short-range direct attack munitions. So, more standoff is needed in the case of the non-stealthy aircraft like B-2s and B-1s. They might have to launch their weapons from 500 nautical miles or even further from high-threat areas along China's coastline, perhaps Kaliningrad in Europe, and elsewhere. And that means they will need to use very long-range cruise missiles like JASSMs and possibly in the future hypersonic weapons.
Got it. So the one area that it seems like we haven't really focused on is the mid-range stand-in arena. If we have a permissible environment, we're really good at the direct attack munitions, and we have the capability to deliver standoff weapons, but they have their limitations. So what are those limitations?
Ah, great question. Now, the capability to launch both those standoff attacks I just mentioned and penetrating stand-in strikes are both going to be needed in a peer conflict. No question about it. However, too great a dependence on standoff can limit a JFAC's options. First, very long-range standoff weapons can have long flight times, and that can reduce their effectiveness against mobile targets like missile launchers that can pack up and move within minutes after launching their weapons. Plus, long-range standoff weapons are limited in the size of the warheads they can carry, and that can reduce their effectiveness against hardened or deeply buried targets. They just don't have enough punch to be able to kill those targets. And of course, weapons range itself could be a limitation, since cruise missiles launched from non-stealthy aircraft that must stand off hundreds of miles from China's coastline might not be able to reach targets located deep in China's interior. And finally, a general rule of thumb is as the ranges of PGMs grow, so do their size and their costs, since they must have an engine to power their flight, fuel for the engine, guidance systems, seekers to steer their warheads to a target, and so on. Plus, more size means aircraft can carry fewer of those weapons per sortie. For example, a B-2 stealth bomber could carry internally, which is important to a stealth aircraft, can carry internally up to about 48 notional stand-in weapons. that have medium ranges somewhere between 50 to 150 nautical miles, while a B-52 can carry up to 20 of those much larger JASSM cruise missiles internally and externally. And it's also important to note that while JASSM is a great weapon, they're just simply too large for F-35 fifth-gen fighters to carry them internally.
Now, Gonzo, I've heard many defense leaders say the enemy has a vote in the nature, scale, and of course the duration of a conflict. From your perspective, how does that apply with the right sizing of the PGM mix?
So, DD has sized its forces for lesser regional operations over the last 30 years, not peer conflicts. And the same is true for its PGM inventory. Plus, DoD is notorious for underfunding its PGM requirements. Case in point is the Air Force almost ran out of its best PGMs during the fight against ISIS a few years ago. So today it's caught out with a PGM inventory that is undersized and unbalanced in its mix of weapons. For context, a fight with China could require U.S. forces to strike 100,000 or more aim points, and that's not unreasonable given the nearly 40,000 targets attacked by the U.S.-led coalition during Desert Storm. These numbers also mean that next-gen PGMs must be affordable if the Air Force is to buy enough of them with a budget that's already severely strained. And that's why our report recommended a unit procurement cost target of about $300,000 or less for new mid-range weapons. And that's why we think to rebalance the Air Force's PGM inventory, it should have a smaller number of direct attack weapons, and of course, a small number of those costly standoff weapons as well. But the gap that's in the middle, that's where we think a lot of our resources actually need to go. Those mid-range weapons have ranges, by mid-range mean about 50 to 250 nautical miles standoff that could cost $300,000 or less, designed to be carried internally by stealth bombers and fighters. And that's what we mean when we talk about fifth-gen weapons for a fifth-gen force. So the idea is to create a weapons mix in the future that balances the range, the size, and the cost of those weapons, while maximizing stealthy bomber and fighter targets per sortie. And those weapons are also going to need to be survivable because of the kinds of threat environments that we'll be launching those weapons into.
Well, Gonzo, thanks so much for the rundown. All right, so now that Gonzo has given us the broad sight picture, let's hear more from the warfighter's perspective from Major General Armbrugast. General, we've talked about right-sizing PGMs to maximize payload per sortie, or perhaps better said, targets per sortie. And what does this mean to you as you think about a high-end fight?
Well, I actually want to build first off of Gonzo's last point about the integrated air defense, because I think it really captures well the strategic environment and what competition has taken place. Kind of while we're paying attention to the global war on terror, a competition was ongoing to push us out, essentially, with the anti-access area denial or counterintervention strategy, like China calls it. What that has effectively done to our platforms is have a sub-effect, if you will, on the weapons themselves, right? So that competition space has existed, and we are now confronting it directly. And so right-sizing PGMs and the precision-guided munition mix is actually going to flow well into rebaselining that competition and the strategy, our strategy to address their strategy. And so I think Gonzo hits a very, very strong point on that mid-range stand-in weapon gap as it currently exists, because what that allows you effectively to do is to bring the generation of your weapons platforms consonant with their capabilities in that operating environment. Meaning if you have a contested airspace or a highly contested airspace, you are no longer confined to overflying the target in a way that endangers the platform. And so it's just really important to address that we, in fact, with weapons can address a strategic competition that has already been underway for some time. Back to echo Gonzo's points on how you actually have a credible and viable force to do that. You know, you need the range, payload, and capacity to really strike those targets or hold those targets at risk in a way where the joint force can operate and your allies and partners in that region are also assured that you are there to act in concert with them.
Yeah, let me add great points, Armo. You brought up the point about our stealth aircraft and having munitions so they won't have to nearly overfly targets, actually overfly targets, like you do with some very short-range direct attack weapons today. By short-range, I mean, you know, JDAMs have a loft range of about 50 nautical miles, depending on release altitude, speed of the aircraft, and so forth, if you're lucky. But the box that we describe, 50 to 250 nautical miles, is all based on sizing a weapon to fit internally on fighters and bombers, stealthy fighters and bombers. Plus, that gives them the standoff they need from targets that are defended by those high-threat defenses surrounding high-value targets. Plus, it gives them more options to penetrate into target areas and avoid threats as well.
Yeah, and I would actually like to add to that as well. So sometimes when we think about weapons range, we just think about a downrange shot, right? A shot off the nose. If you can shoot something 100 miles, you only have to get to within 100 miles of it. But another way to think of it when you have stealth aircraft with large payload capacity in the mix is that range can translate to cross range, which changes the entire geometry of how a fight is conducted. It's not just about getting in and making a max range shot. It is about being able to hit multiple target areas potentially from a single location, which can be planned for to be less at risk. And so what you're effectively doing then with that gap-filling range and survivability is holding not just a single target area or a single range ring at risk, you are holding multiple target areas at risk, which then again increases your ability to unlock the joint effects of the entirety of your force.
Well, sir, that's a great transition to my next question on the capabilities that these munitions need. When we begin to discuss next-generation weapons, what attributes should they have for a fight with a peer adversary in contested or highly contested environments?
Well, so we've actually asked a lot of these same questions to industry in the recent months, and I'm very excited about the responses we're getting across the industry questions, right? And so what I'll do is I'll characterize it by the moment in time, what we have available to us now that we haven't in the past, which is models-based systems engineering and open mission systems, and the modularity that comes with that kind of revolution in data and digital engineering as it's brought into a weapons ecosystem. And so what that allows us to do is to, you know, take a weapon that maybe, for example, as a Mark 84 bomb body or a Mark 82 bomb body, a 2,000-pound class weapon and a 500-pound class weapon, and envision it in something, a different form, right? It could have a seeker package on it. It could have a engine package on it. It could have a network package or a comm package on it. And so what that allows you to do now is take something that historically might have been a single use or a single utility weapon and turn it into something that, due to the ability to fly a range or a pattern that makes it more survivable, it allows it to become something else, something different. And by changing the seeker package on it, what it allows it to do is have different effects at a target, whether it is a mobile missile system, a ship, potentially for counter maritime. You know, the target sets kind of become endless. Now, that being said, there are characteristics that make targets more difficult, and so we aren't going to be able to completely get away from exquisite targeting capabilities like hardened, deeply buried, or deep targets that are highly defended that require something like hypersonics for survivability. But all of those characteristics added together are kind of opening up as we look at open mission systems and the revolution that we're kind of experiencing in that weapons ecosystem that is driving down costs and that is opening up possibilities.
Well, sir, now that you've discussed the capabilities, what about capacity? How many weapons are we talking?
So I think Gonzo actually did a really good job of laying that out in his report, and specifically actually with the graphics in the PowerPoint presentation that accompanies it. it really does show what happens if you don't have the right mix of weapons. What you are locked into is the expense of weapons on non-optimal targets, right? So you have a certain number of targets that you know you need to strike to unlock joint and partner capabilities, but at the same time, you'd like to match your target capabilities or your target requirements to your weapon capabilities. Historically, you're probably hard-pressed to find a situation where you had those matched perfectly in time. In fact, during Global War on Terror, we know we were chasing needed capabilities throughout that, whether it was hitting moving targets with a JDAM-style weapon or, you know, having a lower collateral damage effect for a weapon type to drive down, hit the specific target you're aiming at and not have too far-reaching effects for civilian populations or in urban environments, those kind of things. The same kind of thing is going to exist in that highly contested environment. So what you end up not wanting to do is spending the budget you have or the weapons budget you have against non-optimal targets. And so the exquisite weapons ought to be shot at exquisite targets, which then again, if you have that low cost, affordable mass available to you, what that then allows you to do is to really get after the massive targets that can freeze the conflict in a way that does not allow a fait accompli strategy to happen very quickly.
Yeah, I think that's a great point you just brought up, Armo. The affordable mass, and that's actually part of the title of our report. The whole thrust of that is, what can the Air Force do? What can our DoD do to increase its ability to strike at range with mass and precision? And that's why it really does need, as you say, it needs to rebalance its PGM mix and use exquisite weapons for exquisite targets and not overinvest in them.
General, the Air Force is buying advanced anti-radiation guided missile extended ranges, or AARGM-ER, and stand-in attack weapons and intends to integrate them on the F-35, which is great. Would it be a good idea to also integrate them onto bombers that have even more payload capacity? Also, what are your thoughts on the need for a new maritime strike weapon for the stealth bombers?
So I think anytime I hear about a weapon that's being brought online for the F-35, the immediate thing that enters my mind is, how do we get it simultaneously integrated onto a bomber platform first, and then probably primarily because of the contested airspace and the highly contested airspace onto the B-2 and B-21. Because I'll tell you, what you do when you get them integrated onto a stealth platform is you really force multiply the effect, again, because of what I referenced earlier about cross ranges and the ability to hold multiple target areas at risk, and to penetrate that contested airspace in such a way that you are able to hold deeper targets at risk that, again, can unlock the joint force and the partner and ally participation that then allows real operations to take place. And so, you know, there isn't a weapon that I picture getting integrated on the F-35 that in the future is not brought onto the B-21. As we refine our ability to do long-range kill chain for targets across all domains, what that ought to allow us to do is not tie a weapon type to a weapon platform type. Because again, you know, the transit times, for example, of a long range strike platform are such that you want to have the flexibility as you approach the target area to hit the most effective, highest need target at the time, no matter the domain that it is in. So I think you really do accomplish that by integrating those multi-domain weapons into bomber platforms, long-range strike platforms. Now, maritime, I do see as really, obviously, the question of Taiwan has brought that to the forefront. And so, you know, we have some great capabilities right now across the joint force. I think there's a hunger to evolve those going forward and to increase their capacity going forward. So I think there's a huge opportunity for industry to really look at that and answer those questions. And I know they're spending a lot of internal research dollars to do that, to look at how do we evolve that capacity, evolve that capability to really address the maritime target threat. Again, and it is important to remember, the maritime threat kind of does answer many questions for us as well, because quite often the maritime threats are actually floating integrated air defense systems, right? And so if we can address those targeting problems and those airspace problems that come with them, they really do answer a lot of questions for us as far as capabilities.
Thank you, sir, for your insights. General Armagast, Gonzo, we're getting tight on time, so I want to open up for any parting shots you may have.
Sure. Once again, thank you, General Armagast, for joining us today. But I'd like to end with emphasizing something that the Secretary of the Air Force, Kendall, has been saying in public recently, and that is we really need to develop a future mix of PGMs that will maximize the cost effectiveness of our strikes. It'll maximize our capacity of our ability to strike so we can, frankly, blunt a Chinese or Russian invasion. And that is going to include these mid-range weapons, which we've been discussing, that take advantage, full advantage, of our stealthy platforms, their ability to penetrate closer to targets and use those shorter-range weapons. That and these weapons must be survivable, modular, perhaps with common components to cut their cost and make them easier to ramp up their production during a crisis.
Thank you, Gonzo. General Armagast, any parting shots?
You know, it really is a fascinating topic, and I think it's extremely timely. Again, I thank Gonzo for what he did with that report, because what it did was it brought really good questions to the table. There are certainly some answers in the report, but I think what's even more important is that it brought really good questions to some capability gaps and how do you balance the weapons ecosystem going forward. And I really kind of see that happening for us in the long-range strike community through the strategy that we implement as a nation, how we work with our partners and allies, including in the weapons ecosystem, right? Because we have some ways to be additive to, you know, industrial base, carriage, weapons carriage, training and exercise capabilities with our partners and allies. And we can do that through weapons in ways sometimes that we can't through platforms. And additionally, you know, because we're long-range strike, we talk to numerous COCOMs every week. So combatant commanders are looking for us to bring the answers for long-range strike. And I think the most credible way to get that on the street quickest is actually through weapons and the weapons discussion and the precision-guided munition balance that we strike. And how do we find that low-cost, affordable mass in conjunction with the right balance of hypersonics and hardened, deeply buried target capability? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, what that does for us is it gives credible options for deterrence, right? Because if we get this right, our adversaries will say, well, we're going to continue to compete. We are not going to choose today to make the choice to where we think we can bring this home. So it's a great discussion. It's a great opportunity right now for the industrial base. And I really think we're going to see some interesting choices being made in the near future.
Armo, sir, thanks for your remarks, and thank you again for taking the time to be here with us today.
All right, I appreciate it, and always enjoy hearing Gonzo's thoughts on this topic as well.
And Gonzo, always a pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you, Slick, and thank you, General. Really appreciate it. Till next time.
Thank you, our listeners, for your continued support, and thank you for tuning in today. We've got a lot of new and exciting content coming your way, and this year, we're headed out to air and space events near you, so don't forget to follow or subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn to find out where we'll be and what the Mitchell team has in our sight picture. And please, don't forget to leave us a rating. Hit the like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. Also, leave us a comment to let us know what you think about our podcast and let us know areas you think we should explore further. Please visit us at MitchellAerospacePower.org to read the latest reports, events, and analysis that are charting the vectors for our air and space forces. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.